Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to Gamban.com to find out more. Hello and welcome to the Problem Gambling Podcast. I'm Barry Grant, an addiction counsellor with Extern Problem Gambling. And my co-host is Tony O'Reilly, also an addiction counsellor with the project and co-author of the book Tony 10. And today we had a last minute cancellation. We had some great, couple of great guests booked in, and unfortunately one of them has tonsillitis, and we hope that they feel better soon and we'll have them back in hopefully in a couple of weeks' time. So as a last minute panic job, we said the two of us together would do something on, something we kind of touched on a little bit with Timmy Long last week. He mentioned core beliefs and some of the core beliefs that we all have that kind of drive a lot of our thinking and drive a lot of our emotions and drive a lot of our behaviors. And we touched on the idea of the cognitive model from cognitive behavioral therapy, which is where that idea of core beliefs comes from, and it kind of underpins the whole model, the whole theory behind cognitive behavioral therapy. So we thought we might jump in with some of these today. And look, we're all affected by these. Even if you've never gambled in your life and you're a family member or another person who's listening to this podcast, just because you love the sound of our beautiful voices, whatever the reason is, you are affected by some of these, absolutely guaranteed, right? If you're a human with a pulse, you have negative core beliefs in there somewhere, at least one, and we'll touch on some of the main ones today. So I'll just jump in with some of the main negative core beliefs and just a kind of an idea of what they are in the first place. So starting off, what is a negative core belief? They're fundamental absolutists, so that kind of black and white thinking, and generalized, so generalized out to everything, you know, the all or nothing type thinking. Generalized beliefs that we hold about ourselves, other people, the world, and the future. Negative core beliefs develop in response to early life experiences. So these develop when we're young children with very, very manipulatable, influenceable, I'm making up words here on the spot, minds that are easy to...
Influenceable.
Yeah. Minds that are easy to manipulate and influence, right? I mean, anybody out there who's a parent, or if you're an aunt or an uncle, or you're coming into contact with small children, it's very, very easy to get small children to believe in basically whatever you tell them, right? We all experienced that in many different ways when we were kids, right? So they develop in response to early life experiences and can be divided into three main categories, covering helplessness, lovability, I didn't make that one up, that's what they call it, and worthlessness. All right, so helplessness, lovability, and worthlessness. So if we look at the helplessness ones first, the helplessness ones would be things like, I'm vulnerable. So this would be the kind of self-talk, or even deeper than that, it's more of a sense of who we are as a person. So I'm vulnerable, I'm weak, I'm needy, I'm a victim, I'm stupid, incompetent, I can't cope, very common one. I'm inferior to others, I'm a failure, I'm a loser, I'm defective or broken, I'm not good enough, okay? So let's just look at the gambling side first, and then we'll kind of look at more general type stuff after that. But if you look at the gambling side stuff, if I have a core belief that I'm a loser, and I've picked that up somewhere in childhood, right? So that could have come, usually it comes from some significant caregiver, could be a parent or a guardian, could be a teacher who sticks you at the back of the class, or back in my day, maybe your day, Tony, I'm a little bit older than you. They stood you in a corner and told you what a stupid person you were, and you'd never amount to anything, and maybe gave you a few digs or threw the duster at your head or whatever it was.
Clock to teach you how to tell time.
Yeah, that's why you're so punctual. Obviously, that worked on you.
See it coming at your face.
But some people would literally tell you that you're a loser, and other people would inadvertently tell you that you're a loser. So it could be a little look, you know, from a parent or some other caregiver, something kind of dismissive, or maybe they're cold towards you, or show more love to a sibling than they show to you. And again, a lot of this stuff is perceived, right? So it's perceived to the mind of a small child. So we're not talking a, you know, completely logical response to these situations all of the time. Your parents, your caregivers could have been, you know, like most parents and caregivers, doing their absolute best at all times under difficult circumstances. Anybody who's a parent can relate to that. So we can be responding like if a four-year-old or your five-year-old, when you're at your most programmable, when your these core beliefs are being instilled, it could just be something that your older sibling or your younger sibling or your twin, if you have a twin, you believe or you perceive that they're being treated better or in a preferential way to you, right? Some of these types of things could sink in. So if we look at gambling, I'd often kind of bring this up in counseling. You know, people might say, you know, I feel like such a loser, right? And if you have a core belief that you are a loser, you will seek out behaviors that reinforce that belief. And you will dismiss behaviors and achievements that do not, are not in line with that belief. So if you want to feel like a loser, the perfect place to do that is in a bookie shop, right? Because that's a game that you're always going to lose, right? And obviously people will win individual bets and some people will have a good day at the bookies where they're up at the end of the day. But on, in the long run, everybody loses that game, right? If it's you versus the bookies or you versus the casino, you will be the loser. That's the end result, guaranteed, right? So if you have a belief that you're a loser and you will then engage in behaviors that are likely to reinforce that belief. In cognitive behavioral therapy, they call it a self-fulfilling prophecy. So my starting point is, before I ever cross the door of a bookies or a casino or an online gambling account, my starting point is, I am a loser, I feel like a loser. Then I discover this activity which will totally reinforce that belief, and now I feel comfortable in my skin. Yes, I am a loser. And this behavior, this habit, this thing that I'm engaging in keeps reminding me of that, right? And of course, the very same people who are a loser in the bookies could be high achievers at sport, they could be high achievers in their jobs, they could be high achievers in lots of other aspects of their lives, but they completely dismiss that information because it doesn't fit in with the core belief that they're a loser. Am I making sense so far?
Yeah, and like even you would often hear with clients, like they know even logging on to their account or going to bookies that they're going to lose. They know deep down, but they're okay with that. And again, it's like being in that negative flow state. It's about just when you're in that space, it's just even to maybe push down that feeling or maybe something, there's something going on around that core belief, because core beliefs are generally buried deep within us and they're there. And, you know, I think in recovery, when we do become aware of them, that's when you can start kind of working with that. I know mine always has been feelings of not being good enough, feelings of being inferior, because I was, would say, a year younger than all my friends, and I probably developed that slow rate. So you're constantly comparing yourself to them. I'm not, you know, I'm not strong enough, I'm not big enough. And then when that does get compounded by your teacher saying you're not good enough, or, you know, by either by actions or by non-actions, and then, you know, that I think that stays with you. And it is like a schema or a core belief. It's buried deep and down. And then that can come up at any other stage. And I think Claire Donegan, when she was on a couple of weeks ago, said it really well. She said, I even felt I was failing at recovery. I really thought it was a very powerful statement, because if she felt she was a failure in other aspects of life, it was compounding that she failed at this too, even though you can't fail at recovery, because once you're engaged, it's a process. So yeah, I think feelings of not being good enough was one I've brought through. And then that comparison to then, you know, if my sister was a high achiever, so you're comparing yourself to her all the time and saying, you know, and then you represent she's getting all the opportunities. Of course she was getting, because she worked hard for them. But again, with my perspective, is all I should be getting them as well. But I was the daydreamer. I was the fella in the back of the class staring out into space because I've no interest in school or studying. I'm still like that even when I'm supposed to be reading books on subject matter, still staring out into space. But I think the big one you'll often hear is feelings of not being good enough, insecurities based around childhood experiences. And that's, you know, and you know, when we talk about trauma, I think at times, like, they can be traumatic events, but when generally we mention trauma as well, it can be, or has to be something big, like a car accident or abuse or whatever. But sometimes it can be your perception of an event that can create this, as you said, this core belief. I don't know if I'm making sense there, but again, it's, that would be my understanding of it. And then that can be, it's like the bridge effect. When you're triggered then in any situation of not being feeling good enough, you want to get that quick escape. And what better way to do something to escape out of into your pocket to online to do a bet. And that's why I think gambling is one of the most dangerous addictions, because it's there 24 hours a day. So you can get this feeling that wake up in the middle of the night with this feeling and kind of, oh, I'm going to escape into something to block it down.
Yeah, and if we just stay on the gambling specifically for a second before we go into the more general stuff, like, I mean, do you think there's anything in my theory that people who have that kind of core belief, and like core beliefs, I suppose I better explain this as well. Core beliefs are the deepest level, right? So in the cognitive model, we've got three levels. We've got the superficial level, which is the thoughts in our head, and that's, we hear those all the time, you know, where it's like the one person, one man play that's going on constantly in your head 60,000 times a day. It's just on all the time. And if you're lucky, you can tune it out a little bit or dial it down a little bit through mindfulness practices or keeping yourself busy or other practices like thought stopping. But it's that constant one man, one woman, one person show that's just going on in your head constantly, or thought after thought after thought. Some of those are negative thoughts, and they will be driven in part by the core beliefs. So that's the superficial level. We're aware of that. We have an awareness of it. So we might not very often say the words to ourselves, I'm a loser, or I'm less than other people, right? Because that's the superficial level. The thoughts might be something different, but they will be in that ballpark. Below that, you'd have rules and assumptions about the world. And a rule or assumption that you might have about the world, if you have a belief that you're a loser or that you're less than, the rule or assumption might be something like, I will only be good if I'm 100% perfect at X, Y, and Z. So you see perfectionism tying in with this mindset. Perfectionism, as maybe I've said on the podcast before, I've certainly said it to clients, is a perfect recipe for unhappiness, right? If you're going to be a perfectionist, you will always be unhappy. You will never be happy, right? But there's even that expression, perfection is the enemy of the good. Yeah, and I would say perfection is the enemy of happiness. Sometimes you just have to say, that'll do. That's good enough. Move on to the next thing, right? So it can be that kind of the middle level rules and assumptions, something like, I can only be loved, or I can only be good enough if everything I do is perfect. You're totally setting yourself up for failure, which means you will feel like a loser, right? And all this stuff reinforces the core belief. But the core belief is something so deep, like it's so ingrained that we never question it really outside of therapy. If you're lucky enough, I suppose, to be in a position where you get to unpack this stuff, maybe in a therapeutic setting, it might come into your awareness, like how deep lying this is. And I'd often give the example of, like, if I get a 3-year-old child or a 4-year-old child and tell them there's this big fat fella in a red suit that comes down the chimney every Christmas Eve and leaves loads of presents, they're going to believe that, and they'll believe it for a very long time until somebody comes along and tells them some otherwise, right? But the core beliefs, nobody ever tells you otherwise. Nobody ever says, oh yeah, when I told you you were a loser that time when you were 4, yeah, I didn't really mean that. That's not true. That's just a fairy tale that we made up because, you know, we're having a bad day or a good day or whatever it was, right? The Santa Claus parallel doesn't happen for these core beliefs in real life, right? These core beliefs just trundle along, even though they are irrational, but there is nobody who was born a loser, right? We will have situations where we lose and situations where we are not our best selves and we're not performing at our best. All of us will have that, but that doesn't define who we are as a person, right? So in therapy, you can unpack that and you can put it under the microscope and you can say, okay, you, dear client or dear listener, Tony or Barry, convince me that you're 100% of a loser 100% of the time. And you start at the extremes, because that's that's where the beliefs are. The beliefs are telling you this is who you are all of the time. They're not, there's no nuance to them. There's no thought or belief system saying, well, sometimes you're a bit of a loser, you know, because I definitely am. Sometimes I fuck up, I make mistakes, I'm not my best self, I have a bad day, sometimes I'm lazy, sometimes I'm not, you know, giving it everything I got on a particular day, because I am a human being, and sometimes I have to remind myself of that, as I imagine you do and the listener does as well, right? But being able to unpack that stuff, say in a therapeutic setting, or even, you know, to be able to do it yourself at home and take a moment and say, well, look, is this thing 100% true 100% of the time? Because that's what the core belief tells us, right? Deep down, just the same way a four-year-old child looks at the world in a totally black and white way, that, you know, there's the goodies and there's the baddies and there's nobody in between, right? It's all over one side or it's all completely over the other side. You know, it's the black and white, all or nothing thinking, which is fine when you're 4 or 5, you're trying to make sense of the world and you start at the edges and you work your way into the middle. But when you're 40, that is not helping you, right? I went way, 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 way off there. But I mean, back to the gambling side of things, like, do you think would have a better understanding of the lived experience of that? I mean, do you think I'm way off with the idea that a person who has maybe a core belief that I'm a loser, that I'm less than, is kind of seeking solace in some way in the gambling experience, because it doesn't challenge that belief, it just reinforces it, and it's like a comfort blanket in some ways? Or am I being too psychoanalytic on that one?
No, I was thinking about when you're saying it. I think it does reinforce. I think when I was in the height of it, I was comfortable even when I was losing. Like, you know, you'd often hear people saying, and I know my experience of it was, it's not about winning or losing, it's about how you are in that space. But, you know, at times you will feel that bad beat, you know, or you'll have that kind of extreme reaction to a big win. But generally it is compounding your beliefs that, like, once I went past the point of no return, I kind of went, "Sure, feck it, sure, this is me anyway." Sure, I've been, you know, you're telling yourself that all along that you're no good. So you kind of are a little bit comfortable in that space, even though you shouldn't be. And then there's that kind of, when you come out of that kind of fog as such, you kind of said, how could I do that? Because that's not me. So obviously you're connecting to something deeper line in you rather than your cognitive thoughts process. So I think there is something definitely in that, because like every single gambler you will talk to, and in my experience of it, like knowing some level that what they're doing is wrong, knowing some level that they're not going to win, that they'll still go back in. Like when you are at that point where you are addicted to it, you can't stop and you go back in and keep losing, but yet you're comfortable in that as well. So it is, if that is reinforcing a belief, maybe there's a comfort in that. Yeah, there's definitely something in that. It's an interesting way to look at it, because I do think that would be one. That's all I always, and I know I share with yourself a lot, that my biggest triggers is when I'm feeling that imposter syndrome, or if you have a bad session with a client, you can spiral down to that thinking of, oh geez, I'm no good, I'm not good. Sure, there, everyone was right, you know, the teachers were right, everyone was right. You go right back, even though if you took a step back to say, well, where's the evidence for, well, I had a really good session earlier on and I had a really bad session in the afternoon, maybe I was just tired, maybe it was just the dynamic between the client and the client and the therapist. It's like if I give you 9 compliments, give you one criticism, we always focus on the criticism, because that obviously goes deep down into it. And like even like last night, I was on the phone with my little one and I was saying, sure, I'll bring you back something from going away for work. Like, I'll bring you back something. And Darina even gave me a look, like, and I automatically went into, I'm in trouble. What did I do wrong? Because like, she's an adolescent therapist, so she must know everything she must know everything with the children. But, and I said to her, what was the look about? It was like you were bribing her to come. I said, no, it's just, I'd already told her I was going to bring her something small if I came across. But it's like that, the initial feeling I got as I'm in trouble. And that has one thing that's always been, I go right back to being caught in the corner smoking outside Paul's new bookshop in Carlow and getting that look off me, ma'am, that wait till I get you home look. It goes all the way back to, you know, being caught shoplifting for stamps when I was younger, which is very ironic, actually. It goes all the way back to all that stuff. And that's compounded. I think, like, I didn't write about it in the book because my dad told me to take it out. But, like, there was a thriller thing. I remember I used to go into shop after school with my sister. And, you know, like, I used to love collecting stamps because that made me feel good. I remember we used to play football. I'm probably going off here a bit, but I'll continue anyway. And it was just going in, and it was the trailer chest. I was introduced to it by my friend, said, come on, we'll go down and we'll steal. It was, you know, one of those valves for pumping up a football. And we done it in one shop, which obviously I had more security than one, but it was a rush that I got from it. We were young lads. That's what we stole from Orchards, whatever. But I remember I got caught that day. My little sister was with me, and I got brought into the office. And I never forget. I can still feel the feeling I had. Like, my stomach nearly emptied out onto the table in both ways. And because my younger sister had this over on me was one thing, because I knew that any time she could go telling me. So you're constantly living that way of, I'm in trouble. And then it was, my mom used to do the shopping there. And it was like, she said, do you mind going down to, it's closed now, I don't mind saying it, going down to Dara's and going in and grabbing it shopping because it's a bit cheaper than Quinsworth. I was kind of going, I can't go in because I was told never to come back again. So I used to have to go ask my friend would he cycle down to the shop, and he's going to fuck off and go in yourself. Like, I'm not going down. And there was that stress or that anxiety about, if I go back with stuff from Superquin, I'm going to get found out. So that thing of, I'm going to get caught or I'm going to get discovered, I brought that all the way through with me. And I mentioned another time where I'd been doing my electrician thing, and I left the light plugged up into the thing, and then it really blew myself up. And I wouldn't tell my dad that was, I could have burnt the house down, because that was compounding my earlier core belief that I'm going to get in trouble, or you're bold, or you're whatever else you might do it. And then if you fast forward about even when I started stealing the money to gamble with, it was like that same feeling, I'm going to get caught, I'm going, like, you're going to get in trouble. So they're all kind of interlinked, but that, I think it started from a very young age, that feeling of not being good enough, feeling of you're only a thief, you're only this, you're no good. It's the first time I've ever shared that actually in public, but it's that whole thing. I think that has been compounded for lots of times. Like, every time I feel I'm going to get in trouble. So there's even, you know, I remember ringing you up once or twice saying, oh, someone's after saying something. And I said to you, Jesus, will that have an impact? And you'd be kind of, would you ever stop? You know, there's one example when I made a comment about Stuart Kenny's glasses. Remember, I rang you up in a panic. What will he think? What will he think? And that wasn't about the glasses or the comment, because he just laughed it off. It was all going back to when I was a 9 or 10 year old. I'm in trouble. I don't know whether that kind of gives you a good example of it, but I then think when you bring that into the gambling space, then it's kind of like, I'm in trouble, but it's something that I'm probably been living with all my life anyway. So it's a comfort. It's a comfortable situation being, even though it shouldn't be, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I get that. And yeah, that's a really interesting example. I think for me, I kind of went the other way, where teachers were kind of constantly, although actually I got expelled in primary school, so I should put a little health warning before that, but it got worse in secondary school. And that I kind of played up to it then, and I just kind of acted it out, and I wore the loser thing as a badge of honor, and it was kind of a fuck you, and went the totally other direction, which of course was incredibly immature and self-destructive. I'm not proud of it, but that's what happened, and that was where I was at emotionally at the time. But that, yeah, I think from my own experience, I would have kind of gone completely the other way, where I didn't have shame around it. I saw it as something that empowered me to kind of, you know, fuck the system. I hated secondary school, then I, you know, did jobs for a while that I didn't particularly like, and I there were usually jobs in bars and restaurants where, you know, you'd be doing a lot of drinking and drugging in my free time, and I might do that for 6 months, and I'd blow the job off, and I'd sign on the dole, and I'd mess around, and that became, I think, part of my identity for me, where I just went the other way, and I was proud of that. You know, now that when I'm kind of 50 years of age now, and I'm going, hang on a second, you got a lot of catching up to do in terms of maturity, in terms of, you know, getting a pension together. I'll be retiring if our age group ever get to retire, but whenever that is, all the kind of sensible stuff that a lot of people who would have done their leaving cert same time as me, that I saw as squares, and they were doing all the right things, and I kind of had this badge of honor of doing all the wrong things. Of course they were doing all the right things, and I was doing all the wrong things, but that was my way of coping. It was my way of, you know, I didn't want to curl up into a ball and feel like a loser, so I took it on as a badge of honor, and just made it bigger, you know, and tried to cope with it that way. Both are, I suppose, unhealthy in their own different ways, you know.
I think the shame probably compounded the insecurity. It was probably already there. So when this happened, it was like, it was feelings of inadequacy or insecurity compared to other, you know, your friends or that, it just compounded that. And then when you had to go look for that help or that kind of, you know, you call on him, come on, cycle down and get me, please. Like you're in a vulnerable state the whole time. And like, I think that definitely had a part to play for me not looking for help later on. It was that, and obviously there was attachment stuff there that, you know, that I felt I couldn't go look for help or support because people were unavailable to me at the time. And I think then I kept everything in. So definitely my core beliefs led to the addictive behavior, but also led to the inability to ask for help to get out of that behavior. And then it just got to a point where, you know, like I was even just even talking to a client about today, I just said, like, you know, he said, you probably know yourself, having, you know, having kind of, you know, got recovery, then gone back. And I said, no, I said, I just dug myself right to the bottom. I never asked for help. I always have admiration for anyone who looks for help and support at an earlier stage, because I didn't, because I couldn't. And I think there's elements of not wanting to look for help, or not, sorry, not wanting, not being able to look because of the shame of, and that didn't share, or the stigma of gambling adds that shame as well. So it's constantly being layered up on. So then you just end up just digging your way to further and further and further until I hit that bottom plate, and the whole place comes crumbling down around you. But then even when I was, you know, at various points in recovery, I found it hard to ask for that help because of that shame was being compounded the whole time in a different way. But then when I kind of managed to get around that, or managed to say, oh, it's okay to feel vulnerable, it's okay to feel insecure, it's okay to look for help, that's when the recovery process really started to kick in. And that was probably in prison, you know, because I just kind of, because I had the prison sentence hanging over me, I just kind of, when I was in treatment, I just about got my way through it. I didn't know what I was doing, to be honest, because I'd all this big stuff in coming down the line. But it was in prison then when you have to look for that help, or you have to look for that support. I think that started the healing process, but yet you'll still be triggered by it every so often in different ways. And that's why, you know, I honestly think the insecurity and the core belief of feeling not good enough are the two main things that would be my internal triggers. And they can't go above any external triggers, because they're constantly being, you know, we were talking about this morning, like they're constantly being, you know, you're constantly getting situations where you feel insecure or you feel not being good enough. And then it just layers up and layers up. And the next thing is you're looking to addictive behaviors to escape from those feelings. And you're kind of saying, I don't need to be spending money, or I don't need to be eating chocolate, or I don't need to be doing any of this stuff. But that's the coping skill that I've developed outside of gambling. It's mad when you think about it, because even when you know it or you name it, you still can't stop it when it comes at you at times. And that's the scary bit. Because they're so ingrained in us. But I'm getting better. I had a few big realizations last couple of weeks. Like, as I always say, I've probably done more work on myself the last year in regards to personal development than I have in the previous 10 years in recovery, because I'm finally open to kind of looking at these things. And criticism is a big one as well. And perfectionism was a big one. That was a huge one. I was sharing with you the other morning as well, that when I got a Liverpool book through the post one day and the corner was bent, I had to throw it out because I couldn't sit with the fact that it was damaged. When I'm reading books, you wouldn't know I'm after reading them. I've gone better at that. And I would think it was a college that helped me with that, because I dropped out of college, I again had the core belief that I'm not good enough, I'm not able for college. When I went back to college to do the counselling, the first year or two, I was putting myself under terrible pressure, saying, you have to get a first, you have to be the best at this, because you failed at it before. And then when I was kind of, I think it was when I was talking to my partner at the time, I just said, I don't have to get the best, I just get through it. But I was putting myself under so much pressure. But when I allowed myself not, as you said, when I allowed myself not to have to be perfect at it, there was a huge freedom in that. And we don't have to be perfect in recovery. And there's another people I talked to as well, like, you know, they go back to old behaviors. I go back to old behaviors. I don't beat myself up too much about it, because I'm not going back gambling. If I go back gambling, I think that's the bottom line for me. I'm in trouble because I know what I'm capable of. But if I do a little bit of the shopping, or a little bit of, you know, a little bit of behavior that I would be kind of, probably not conducive to really good recovery. I'm not beating myself up as much because I'm not perfect in my recovery. And I think that's a big part to play for me in the last couple of years and probably enhancing the recovery because, it, as you said, when there's acceptance around that, there's a freedom in that as well. So yeah, it's a really good thing. But I was coming onto the podcast, which before I'm kind of what we want to talk about. This is going to be like pulling teeth for the next 40 minutes. But when you really dig down into it and process it, it really does help to kind of have the acceptance around it that, you know, our core beliefs are not us, or our core beliefs don't have to be the one that dominates my actions or my thoughts or my behaviors.
Yeah, they don't have to, because if we bring them into consciousness, we have an awareness of, okay, this is driving this behavior. This is driving this emotion, or this set of emotions. Like when you were talking there, I was thinking about that. You know, there's the unconscious thing maybe of, I feel like a loser. I have a core belief that I'm a loser. So I go to the bookies that reinforce the belief, like I was talking about earlier on. But then you're talking about help seeking. Help seeking is where you consciously feel like a loser rather than an unconscious drive. So it's bringing that most painful thing, the belief, the core belief that I'm a loser, into consciousness, where something like gambling, once it's a habit, there's no conscious thought going on anymore. You're not going, am I doing this because I feel like I'm a loser? No, you're just doing it because you're in a habit loop. You're on the hamster wheel. There's no conscious thought going into it. But when you seek help, like I often think of the example of somebody barring themselves from the local bookies. Might live in a small town or a village. Maybe there's one bookies and they're going, oh, I don't want to go in there. People will know I have a problem. And I would say, I guarantee you. I'm not a betting man, right? But I guarantee you they know you have a problem, right? If you're calling us, the reason you're calling us is you know you have a problem, and like you're at the pointy end of the problem by this time you're contacting us, because most people, it's the last thing they do. They'll do everything else before they contact us, right? So if you're contacting us, I would bet my vital organs that everybody in the bookie shop who works there knows you have a problem, right?
It's funny you say that, because I was talking to someone the other day about, like, you know, you talk about time, access, money, right? Like we always do. And we're saying about getting gambling on the phone. I can't get gambling on the phone because, you know, if it'll be tracked. Like the people will know that I've gambled and I have a problem with gambling. I said, well, they're probably, after seeing your 100 transactions on Ladbrokes for the last couple of months, they'll probably presume you have a problem for that. Or in the world of Big Brother, like every time we go into Ladbrokes or anytime we go anywhere, we're probably being pinged somewhere. From being in there anyway, so people know. And it's funny that, like, you know, I don't, because of a privacy thing, and that's where people will try to find ways not to, you know, they look for the help, but they don't want to go the final bit. And that's the, isn't that the final bit of letting go of that thing of that it's the acceptance bit, isn't it? That, you know, I have to do a couple of things here that I don't really want to do to help me. But it's just funny, you know, when you're saying that, like, it's kind of, yeah, we are like everyone and their dog knew I had a problem, bar the people around me. It's everyone in the places where they saw you doing it. And like, even when people are in recovery and they do have a lapse or a relapse, it's always the partners will know, it's the old behaviors. And the person's oblivious to say, sure, I was, you know, I was covered on my tracks. How did they know? Like, but they know because they see us, because we think we're better at covering tracks than we actually are. So.
Yeah, partners are great at spotting that, and it's amazing the amount of people, you know, the missus knew that I'd had a better, that I was thinking about doing, about the mood swings, the mood changes. You start now, sometimes partners and loved ones will jump when there's nothing happening, and that's very frustrating for people in recovery as well. You're doing all the right things, you're just having a bad day, you're stressed at work, whatever's going on, maybe a family member is sick or some other thing has you feeling stressed, and then your loved one is going, "Will you back gambling?" Because they see it in that kind of fight or flight mode, where the fight or flight kind of casts the net really wide, and it goes, well, I recognize this, and this. I remember that pattern, therefore it equals gambling, whereas it could also be other things. So yeah, on the one hand, family members are usually really good at spotting when it is a slip, but also sometimes they'll kind of overcorrect, and anything that kind of vaguely reminds them of when the person was gambling can be part of it as well. But we might be getting slightly off track there in terms of the core beliefs.
But that's okay too.
Yeah.
But I think, like, sometimes the partner might be might have the opinion that the person is fixed as well, and their eyes do come off the ball as well. So there is a couple of things that can happen. But I think the most important bit about that is to have the conversations about this, to bring it into the room. And be conscious of your defenses about being challenged, because again, that could be back linked to core beliefs. I'm bringing it back on track now, as you can see.
Yeah, very good. That was good.
There you go.
And I will say one thing though, it's not the partner's job to have their eye on the ball all the time either.
No.
Right. That's if you're listening to this, you're in recovery, that's your job. Your partners and other loved ones can help you, but it like they have their own stuff going on as well, right? They can help you, but you can't rely on them having their eye on your ball 100% of the time.
Yeah. Right? If we can have open and honest conversations and check-ins and, you know, be open and honest about how we're doing, how they're doing, how they feel we're doing. And it does open transparent conversations are the things that can help, because it isn't their job, but it can be a way to help and support for both sides to have that awareness or create that awareness.
Absolutely. Okay, so that was a little bit of the helplessness beliefs, and we focused a lot on the one, like the idea of feeling like a loser or not good enough. They're broadly speaking in that helplessness grouping, right? This kind of, and quite often you see that with anxiety as well. It's that overwhelming feeling of I can't cope. You know, that's really intense. You know, anybody who's ever had an anxiety attack, like that's full on. And quite often that can come from that place, that general place of helplessness. The next one is unlovability. And some of the kind of thoughts within that might be I'm unlikable or I'm unlovable, unwanted, you know, for people who've been rejected in some way as a child. I will be rejected or abandoned in the future. I'll always be alone, right? So again, a lot of this stuff, all of this stuff is formed in childhood, right? So again, maybe you felt that you were rejected. Maybe you actually were rejected by a parent or a guardian or a significant caregiver. Some people will have gone through the care system. They may have been abandoned by a parent, or a parent might have died when they were young. And again, a child's mind would perceive that as abandonment, even though obviously that wouldn't have been the plan of the parent or the motivation of the parent. So that unlovability bit, and I suppose if we feel that we're not worthy of love or that it's not possible for other people to love us, it's very, very easy to hit the self-destruct button in that situation. You know, there's a kind of a logic to it in terms of, well, why wouldn't you hit the self-destruct button? If you were so horrible that you can't be loved even by the most important people in your life, and usually this comes from, you know, relationship with parents or other significant caregivers, right? Because it's formed at a time when they would be the most important people in our lives, right? So some sense of rejection, again, I've seen it loads, and maybe you've seen it in your own work, Tony, as well, that the sibling thing can be massive. You know, the amount of, I went through a period when I started out counseling where I had about four or five clients on the go at the same time, all of whom were massively impacted by the fact that there were way more photographs of their siblings as children in the family album than there were of them, or on the mantelpiece in the house or up on the walls or wherever it was. And it could be the oldest child, it could be the middle child, it could be the youngest child, whatever it is. Something happened somewhere along the line. The family broke the camera or whatever it was, or maybe it was something deliberate, who knows. But I had such, and these are people in their 40s, 50s, maybe older. And it was still such a deep, deep, hurtful thing. Now, you might be listening to this, dear listener, and having a little chuckle to yourself and going, "Ah, that's silly." But I guarantee it's a thing, right? Like, Tony, have you ever come across that one?
Yeah, there's not many of me up in the house. So
no, oh, here you go.
Middle child syndrome. No, yeah. And it's something like it wouldn't bother me as much, but I noted it once. Oh, look, there's all these collages been done. Oh, I made it into one. And even when my daughter is doing it now, I say, oh, geez, I made it into it. It's kind of, it is there within me, that. And it's, I don't know if I would say that I felt unloved. I might have felt left. I might have felt just left. It was always that I always felt that I was just left be. No, maybe not unloved. I was the focus wasn't on me. And part of me, even perversely, even when I was in the height of the gambling, kind of thinking that I'll make his notice me. Now, I don't know whether that's conscious or subconscious. I don't know whether that was a conscious decision, but part of me, even at the later stages, oh, you'll notice me soon. You'll see it in a lot of the films, you know, the people who go in the background make this big thing to be noticed. But I do think with that not that kind of sense of not being loved, I think that can lead to self-loathing or hurtfulness. And then that can lead to, you'd often hear people talk about, but then punished, feel like they're punishing themselves while they're in the, or like nearly like a self-harm by gambling and getting into trouble. So there could be links, I think, within that, I reckon.
Yeah, and even that thing of, you know, from the mind of a 4 or 5 year old child, obviously you weren't 4 or 5 when you were in the height of the gambling, but you know, the core belief, you know, I'd often say like the core beliefs were like Russian dolls, you know. The 4 or 5 year old you is in the middle there somewhere still. Or they haven't gone anywhere, they're in there, you know, there's this inner child kind of theory within psychology, and a lot of people kind of focus on that work. I think there's a lot in it. To be honest, although it's not my area, but the way I would see that is like we're Russian dolls, and now, right now, today, you're the exterior doll, but inside you are all the other dolls of previous versions of you, right? And somewhere in there is a little 4 or 5 year old version of you, and that 4 or 5 year old version of you, if they felt they weren't getting enough attention, would act out to get some form of attention, you know, and all forms of attention are attention. Right. And that's all that really matters to a small child, really, you know. So, and quite often in family dynamics, again, it's not my area either, but that's a whole field of psychology and counseling, that quite often you'll get the firstborn child, which I am, of course, golden boy, you know, goody two shoes.
Not expelled primary school, goody two shoes. Yeah.
So there's that. And then you'd have younger siblings. Quite often, the oldest child is given the role of like they've no one to compete with. So they're naturally, doesn't always happen that way, but it often happens that way, that they're in this kind of golden child zone, right? Not always. And that's it. That is a difficult mantle to wear as well. It comes with its own set of problems. It's not without problems. It comes with a different set of problems. But then the next child that comes along goes, well, I can't compete with that. They've a, whatever, 2-year, 3-year, 5-year head start on me. They can do things I can't do. So I just can't compete with that older golden child. So I'll find another way of getting attention and do the opposite. Right? You're still getting attention, which is the name of the game for your small child. And you're doing it in a way, you're adapting to the situation to give yourself the best chance of getting what you want. Right? Again, small child, right? Driving all this sort of stuff. But again, if you're the child who was, let's say that two, we'll take that two child dynamic for a second. The older child who's the golden child, who's used to having 100% of the love and attention 100% of the time from both of their parents, has now been usurped by the younger child. So they can feel unloved because the younger child is getting as all this attention, they're cuter, they can't do stuff for themselves, so they need more care and attention. Just logistically. And then as time goes on, the younger child might start acting out, getting negative attention, still attention, and they feel unloved. So you could have two siblings there, very different scenarios. One is supposedly the golden child, one is supposedly the bad child or the demon child or whatever it is, all these horrible things that we refer to children as sometimes. Both come away from a feeling unloved. Do you know what I mean?
What happened to you then as a firstborn?
What happened to me as a firstborn? Well, oh God, how long have we got?
How long we have? No, you don't answer. It's a rhetorical question. That one. Yeah, it makes sense. Like you often see it portrayed in films, Hollywood films, like the older child, like the boss baby comes to mind when you say it, like stuff like that. It does. It's, and it's that dynamic. And yeah, it's interesting because it does play a part in our kind of attachments and our kind of development later on in life. And that's why we can get unhealthy attachments to behaviors or to substances later on in life. And I think that's where, I think, again, it's not a blame, but it's one of a number of reasons why I believe that I, when gambling came along, it was kind of like, oh, this is the thing I've been waiting for. I feel loved in here. I feel accepted. I feel everything in here. I feel alive in here. But then that feeling is very much short-lived because, as we know, you have to get more of it to get the same feeling and leads to more trouble. But then I think, as I said, it switches then to kind of, it really compounds some of the other stuff that's there, the deeper line stuff. It's yeah, it's interesting when you pull it apart.
Yeah, so the unlovable one, I mean, we could spend, I don't know how many hours talking about that because family systems are super complicated. Like they're just, like we work with individuals essentially. Even group dynamics are complicated, but once like family dynamics just that's like, you know, you want to be a professor of something or other to make your way through that stuff. It's unbelievably complicated, right? And most people think that everybody else's families are super functional and everybody gets on, and you know, it's just my family that's a bit dysfunctional or super dysfunctional or whatever way you want to look at it. Having worked with a lot of people over the years, I can pretty much guarantee you that everybody's family is at least a bit dysfunctional, right? And has a lot of these dynamics going on, even with the best of intentions of the parents and, you know, doing their absolute best to make sure that these things don't happen. Right? Their absolute best. Some of this stuff is going to happen. There's that great poem, I can't remember the title, but the famous line is, they fuck you up, your mum and dad. And then the final line is that, you know, when you become a parent, you're going to fuck your own kids up too, right? That's, it's a bit fatalistic, but that's just the nature of it. And I think it's a healthy way to look at it, because your parents were a product of their parents and they were a product of their parents. And every generation, I think, is trying to do something different to what their parents did in terms of what they view as the mistakes, and in doing so, normally we throw the baby out with the bathwater a little bit and make some new mistakes, and on it goes. Like, but we're all just trying to do our best, and this isn't, this whole core belief thing isn't about parent bashing, right? It absolutely isn't. I think all of us would say, or certainly I would say, that my parents, through all their difficulties and everything that went on, were always trying to do their best under difficult circumstances. And I think that's true of most parents most of the time.
I think that shame thing is generational too. So that's been carried down through the generations too. So a lot of times that's nearly ingrained in us as a core part of us as well. Like, you know, you look at colonialism all the way down through the church scandals and all the way down, you know, it's like, you know, you look at reeling back the years and you just see them outside. I don't know what film it was. I could have mentioned this last week in the podcast, I think. But they're outside protesting against some film that was brought out. It could have been whatever it was. It could have been Life of Brian or something later than that. But it's like that whole thing. I was like, it's definitely generational. And definitely as a society, I think shame is wanting that is carried down. And like our parents would have, as you said, done the best in very different times, different circumstances. But I think it is changing a little bit. But if that's ingrained in us, then from our experience of childhood through their experience of life, it's going to take a little bit more for that too. And then we're going into the whole area of social media, when people are being shamed left, right, and center on social media for not looking a certain way or acting a certain way and having as many friends. Or so, like, it's even coming down the road in a different way. And I do think shame is one of the big core beliefs out there as well. I think, like, not being good enough, I think it's nearly attached to all the other negative core beliefs as well.
Yeah, and I suppose for parents out there, or if you're a parent listening to this, I mean, in some ways our parents' generation, like, I was born in the early 70s, you were born in the kind of mid 70s, something like that, or towards the
early to mid.
Early to mid, Tony, of course, yeah. Or mid to late, who knows, yeah. Like, the pressures on parents, the societal pressures on parents at then were not the same. Now, families were bigger, so that is definitely a pressure. But let's say for fathers, the expectations were zero, basically, or close to zero, right? You did your job, you went to the pub. That was pretty much it in the 1970s and before that. And then, which is a good thing, more and more pressures came on fathers to actually do some bloody parenting, right? So that's good. But I think broadly speaking, there are just way too many pressures on parents now to be the perfect parent at all times, to read a million baby books and parenting books, and to be, you know, involved in every single activity and wrapping their kids up in cotton wool and over involved and over analytical and over critical. And of course, that leads to huge amounts of shame and this feeling that I'm failing as a parent. And that, you know, for a lot of people, that's a real challenge as well. But it's the most complicated job any of us will ever have. And, yeah, we're all just trying to do our best, really. So love yourself a little bit. We're all failing all the time, right? But it's just to try and do our best within that, I think.
So any children listening, go easy on us as
parents. Yeah, yeah, please, God.
Yeah.
Take it easy. Okay, and then the final category within these kind of negative core beliefs is the worthlessness ones. And I suppose worthlessness, When I hear worthless, I can hear it two ways. So there's worthless, where meaning worth nothing, that I feel like I'm totally worthless. And then there's also, I feel like I'm worth less than other people, that kind of less than, which comes up a lot. But the thoughts around that might be, I'm worthless, unacceptable, broken, toxic, I'm bad, I'm evil, I deserve punishment, pain, suffering, right? And that ties in as well. Like, a lot of these overlap with each other. It's not like they're kind of totally divided from each other. So, I mean, again, for somebody from the outside looking in, looking at any addictive behavior, and possibly more so with gambling, because people just struggle to understand how it can be addictive in the first place. People see it as irrational and selfish and stupid. And why would you just keep hitting the self-destruct button like that over and over again? Why don't you just stop, right? And if you believe that you're worthless, you're broken, or you're toxic, and that you deserve punishment, you're probably going to continue to punish yourself. Right? And again, all this stuff comes from our childhood, and it's unlikely that you had a parent or a caregiver or a teacher saying the words, "You deserve punishment." But they could have been acting that out in a way that would communicate that message to the child, to the mind of a 4 or 5 year old child or younger. Right? You don't have to say the words, "You deserve punishment, Tony," or "You deserve punishment, Barry." All you have to do is punish the child. And it could be for some fairly minor transgression. And then that belief might start sinking in. Yeah, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. Yeah, definitely.
And for some people, again, this is something that quite often comes up in therapy. The memory, or the sense memory, or the belief, or the feeling is, if you have siblings, that I was the one who was singled out for more punishment than my siblings. Now, that may very well be true, right? But memory, first of all, is a very flaky thing, as we all know. And you'd see that a lot in terms of gambling has a big impact. Perceived fairness, I would have seen it with my own kids. There's only a couple of years between the two of them growing up. Like, everything had to be exactly the same. And as the oldest sibling with two younger siblings, like, if we got a bottle of lemonade and some ice cream, like, my job was to pour everything. So I'd have to, like, measure the glasses up beside each other. So everything was exactly the same. And the bowls of ice cream were exactly the same, or else World War III would kick off, because kids are obsessed with fairness, right? In a way that doesn't really translate into the adult world, because adults, we kind of learn to accept that bad things happen to good people sometimes, and that life isn't always particularly fair. But when you're a small child, fairness is everything, and that kind of competition with siblings is going on a lot of the time, and the perceived mistreatment or perceived unfairness or perceived kind of perception that you're receiving more punishment, say, than your siblings might. Would you see that coming up, Tony, with clients?
I think there is that comparison piece the whole time. And I think, I suppose, our generation as well, like, when you are punished, or when you feel you're being punished, I do think it does create feelings of worthlessness, feelings of, well, also feelings I deserve it, or I must deserve it. And I think when we are in, when you look at the feelings that come up when you're gambling, it's like feelings of worthlessness, feelings I deserve it, or feelings that, sure, I'm no good anyway. So what's the point? And again, you'd often hear as well, sure, I'll do it because that's what they expect me to do anyway. So, like, if you take up that mantle of the person who is the, inverted commas, troublemaker, when you're in that space, you kind of go, sure, that's what's expected of me anyway. So again, like, I do think it's one I suppose I was trying to think about my own situation when you were saying. I don't think I related to that one as much as the first two, but definitely in school, like, I suppose I was always the one in the limbo. I wasn't, being punished too much, because I always kept in the background because of my other stuff going on. But at home, definitely there was, sometimes I would be punished for something. I kind of go, like, I didn't deserve that. And then you can say, well, no one else is getting this. And again, but now I look back and now I go on and say, like, it's the, my parents were doing the best they could at the time. So again, there's no blame to it, or they're going through their own stuff, whatever. But at the time, it can have a huge impact into how you navigate that developmental part of your life. And then I think what happens, but for me anyway, what happens is then is that whole thing of that it keeps coming up until you can own it, package it, and heal from it and have compassion towards yourself and others around it. When it comes up over and over again, it's very triggering in recovery, or very triggering while you're in that space of gambling, that it's, and you don't know why. You're kind of going like, I couldn't stop. I know what I'm doing is wrong, but I couldn't stop. But if you can kind of understand where it may be coming from, now you mightn't be totally all of one thing, it might be totally all of another thing. But if it's part of the reason why gambling became the solution to it, if you understand it a bit more, and if you go into that place of awareness, it helps you have a choice not to act on that thought or belief or feeling when it comes in.
Yeah, and I think being able to challenge these, now these are harder to challenge than the automatic thoughts, and I suppose a lot of what we do in counseling and therapy is we're trying to encourage people, rather than just nod along and go along with whatever negative automatic thought pops into your head, is be able to challenge it and put up some sort of defense to it and be able to pick it apart a little bit, right? That's what's important. Core beliefs take a little bit longer because they're really, really, really deep rooted. You know what I mean? And let's say, okay, I'm not having a pop off religion here. I'm not religious. I don't know if you're particularly religious. It's never come up, right? But let's say I was raised Catholic because I was born in Ireland at a certain time, and all of my family were Catholic, so I was raised Catholic. I didn't have any choice in the matter. Nobody kind of waited until I was 18 and said, well, look, here's 20 different religions and this is what they all say and pick one, right? That just didn't happen. I was indoctrinated into the religion of my family, right? Like many, many other people. But if I had been born in Pakistan, I would have been indoctrinated into a completely different religion. And if I was born in Tibet, I would have been indoctrinated into a totally different religion, and so on, right? So if I get someone in their 30s or 40s coming into the counseling room and I started challenging their religious beliefs, I would never do that, right? This is not, I'm making an analogy here. But that's something that's very, very deeply ingrained. So even if the person wasn't practicing their religion or didn't have any strong feelings about it, if I started saying, well, okay, you know, prove there's a God or disprove there's a God or whatever it is, that would be a bit of a challenge for most people, even if they're not particularly religious, because at a very formative time in their lives, they were indoctrinated. And I'm not saying that in a negative way. That is literally what the term means. Right? So we're indoctrinated into a certain set of beliefs. Some of them are religious. To get that person to pull those apart completely and come at it like some sort of super logical robot, right? That would be really difficult to do, and it's debatable whether it would be appropriate to do that or not. So the core beliefs are in there, right? They're really, really, really deep in there. Our parents and our caregivers usually are not standing there deliberately indoctrinating us with these negative beliefs, because for the most part, like we said, most parents are trying to do the best for their kids most of the time and care about them and love them for the most part, right? Most parents are accidentally indoctrinating their children with all these weird, wonderful, unhealthy, unhelpful beliefs by accident, in exactly the same way that their parents accidentally indoctrinated them into their unhealthy core beliefs, and on and on and on and on. So we're not going to get this solved in a 1 hour podcasting session, right? But it's just important to bring some of this stuff into consciousness and to be able to have a better understanding of, okay, why do I keep doing this self-destructive thing? Like, what am I getting out of it? You know, again, if we go back to the idea of I'm a loser, on the one hand, you can have, within the one person, you can have somebody engaging in totally self-defeating, self-destructive behaviors, like taking on the bookies, for example, or taking on a casino. That's guaranteed loser. That's what's going to happen, right? And the person knows that logically at some level, but continues to do it. The exact same person, I mean, like yourself, you were high functioning, you were the youngest post office manager in the country at the time, high achiever, right? And many, many of the people that we work with and have worked with over the years are very, very, very high achievers outside of the gambling or outside of other addictions or other issues that they might have. So on the one hand, there's the core belief that I'm a loser, and the comfort and the reinforcement that a person gets from engaging in self-defeating, self-destructive behaviors. And at the same time, there's the opposite drive to disprove the belief that you're a loser by achieving all of these things that so many of the people that we've worked with have achieved. Like, both of those things can and often do occur in the same person, but they're both manifestations of the same thing. You know, they're both overcorrections of the same thing. Am I making sense?
Yeah, and it's about getting that balance back then in recovery, isn't it?
I think so.
Which can be difficult, because you have the early recovery, you have the all the, you know, this all this the negative core beliefs that you have will be reinforced in recovery a lot of times. And then, you know, for me, it was like, I was a high achiever. I did get the position very young, and even in early recovery and in early training, that's where the perfectionism was coming from. It's like, I have to get back to that level in some shape or form. And I don't know where that kind of comes into to the point you were making, but it's that kind of a belief that I have to be the best at, because it's that's what I was beside the gambling as well. So it's kind of, it means that part of me felt I had to go be the best at it again. It's only when I said, no, I don't have to be the best at it. And then I was able to kind of balance it all up a little bit and accept some of the, when the corporates come up, challenge them and accept them and accept that I'm not never going to be 100% or perfect, or I'm going to have bad days and good days. And I think that's sometimes in early recovery as well, people think that it has to be perfect, and it's okay not to be okay. It's okay to have a shitty day. It's okay to be thinking around gambling. It's okay to you know, go along that continuum of relapse, as long as you don't get to the end, if you can catch it. And that's where recognizing automatic thoughts and negative beliefs can come in as well. But I think it all stems from the trigger of a lot of these core beliefs that you're talking about.
All righty. Well, dear listener, hopefully you find that some way useful. Again, some of this stuff can be confusing, and it's definitely worth doing your own little bit of reading on it. There's a lot of great stuff out there. I mean, the cognitive behavioral therapy model has been around for a long time. But once you kind of see these core beliefs and see how much they can drive your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, like, they do have a massive impact. There's no two ways about it. And to be able to challenge them and repeatedly challenge them and repeatedly challenge them and seek out the evidence. Let's say, just before we finish up, if somebody tells me, you know, I feel like I'm worthless, so I'd say, okay, convince me, go, convince me how worthless you are. And, or, you know, would your child say the same thing? If I brought your child in here today, would they tell me that you're worthless? Or would your parents tell me that you're worthless? Or would your partner tell me that you're worthless? Do all of your coworkers and friends think that you're worthless? Are they all wrong by thinking that you're not worthless? Do you know what I mean? It's through the repeated challenging, because most of us will go through long, long, long periods of our lives repeatedly reinforcing these core beliefs and seeking out information that reinforces those negative core beliefs, ignoring all the other information that challenges, because we don't know how to process that. It just feels uncomfortable. It feels wrong. But I suppose it's a process of trying to let in the stuff that feels wrong and let in the stuff that does challenge the negative core beliefs, and allow those two things to sit together and allow that to be over time integrated. But like, this is not a flick of a switch thing, right? If you're in your mid-30s listening to this, you've had 30 years of programming and reinforcement over and over and over again. Doesn't mean it would take you 30 years to get out of it, but it's something just to bring into your consciousness and try and bring into your awareness and bring into your kind of your, if you're doing any sort of mindful practice, or just even if you were journaling, say, day to day, to be able to say, well, look, what was I doing today? What was driving that? where might that be coming from? Like, there's, it's very, very useful. Did you have something there, Tony, before we finish?
Yeah, I was going to finish off with, I got this book this morning, Find Your Best Self, Recovery from Addiction Trauma. I just love the analogy of living with addiction. I'm just going to read it out before we finish up. It said, living with addiction or trauma is sort of like growing up on a boat. The ground is always moving underneath you. Sometimes you learn to stay upright when the water is gentle, but at times it's completely impossible. And it's all you can do is lie flat and hang on for dear life. Coming into recovery is like washing up on the shore and standing up. Even though you're on solid ground, it takes a while to stop reeling and constantly counterbalancing, because that's all you know. People on land might look at you like you're insane for hanging on to a railing, because they've always stood on solid ground and can't understand being that involuntary and balanced. Over time, you start to gain your land legs, though, and stop having to reel back and forth just to stay upright. Then you wake up one day and realize that you can walk a straight line on dry land for the first time. You always remember the book and roll and learning to walk again, but you learn to stay upright and walk among the land people.
Oh, I like that. Walk among the land people, Tony. Let's try
that. That's what I'm doing now. I'm walking along the land people. I was with Kevin Costner in Waterworld for so long.
All right, folks. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week, hopefully broadcasting from Norway, if you can believe that, up in the Arctic Circle. So that's going to be interesting. Thanks a million for listening. Take care. Bye.
Cheerio.
The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to Gamban.com to find out more.